Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really awesome founder, you know, joining us, a founder that has done the full cycle, you know, and quite successfully. And today, you know, we're also going to be talking about what his latest chapter is, you know, his latest company. You know, we're going to be talking about the building, the scaling, the financing, the exiting, also thinking about AI, how it's going to change work, how work works, also how the adoption goes with enterprise as well. So brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Adam Schwartz. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. I'm excited to speak with you.
So originally born right outside of Boston, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Yeah, my family is all native New Yorkers, but I grew up outside of Boston because there's this famous loop called the 128 loop in Boston, where all the sort of biotech and high tech companies have their headquarters. And my dad was a part of the sort of earliest wave of semiconductors in the 70s and 80s. And so that's how he ended up there. And that's sort of how I grew up with kind of the all of this technology in my backyard.
So obviously you eventually went to Florida, and then from there you came to New York City. How did you start it to get, you know, your feet wet into the whole venture world? Because back then, you know, the whole ecosystem of startups in New York was not that existent.
Yeah, this is around 2008. And my older brother was here already, a couple of years older than me in New York. And he was working for a startup that actually had, I think, probably the first co-working space in New York, I would guess. It was called, basically the analogy to what it was, it was called AngelSoft. It's kind of like what AngelList is now. There was an organization at that time called the New York Tech Meetup, which was, if you know meetup.com, it was the founder of meetup.com created the New York Tech Meetup as the first meetup on meetup.com. And the New York Tech Meetup was essentially, you could fit the whole of the New York tech ecosystem in one room, a couple hundred people. And so I'm 23. I don't really know what I'm going to do. But I always had like an itch to be an entrepreneur. That always felt resonant to me. I didn't really know how to do that. And I went into this room and everybody was building something on the internet. And it was infectious and really inspiring. And I knew like I had found my community and found my people. And I was really, I think, lucky to be there at that time because the community was so small, you could talk to anyone, everyone would help you. And there was a lot of people who were in that room that now today have built, you know, multi-billion dollar companies and some of the most successful venture funds that you know of. But it started, you know, with that nucleus. And so there was a lot of really, really cooperative and collaborative energy at that time that I sort of got swept up in.
Now, that was back in 2009, you know, which is when you also built your first company, LeSouq. I know that, as they say, you either succeed or you learn. You know, there was a lot of learning with LeSouq. So tell us what happened there with LeSouq and what were some of those lessons that you had to take with you?
Yeah, I mean, I started when we started that company, I think I was 24, you know, and so I think I got over those 2 or 3 years, like a complete lesson, you know, in all of the ways that you can go wrong to table set. You know, we were a marketplace, an e-commerce marketplace, where fashion brands and designers could source sustainable textiles from suppliers. And so we were trying to connect these two, you know, we were trying to connect a supply side to a buy side, but the supply side, which was textiles, you know, which funnily enough was my family's business going back. You know, my grandfather was in textiles in New York in the 40s, walking down the same street that my office was then on, selling textiles, and we were building this company out of an old textile mill that had now been converted to a loft. But this had all just happened sort of organically. And what we essentially found there was that the supply side just, you know, really wasn't ready to change the way that they work to conform to this like digital marketplace of doing business. It's a very, at least then, and I suspect even still, a very relationship driven business. And so I think we didn't validate enough that the demand was real, that we were solving. There was real demand and there was a real problem. There was pain in the product that we were building. But the stakeholders were not really willing to change, you know, or at least we weren't able to get them to. We also had misalignment among the co-founder group about what to do about that and about how to iterate and pivot the business as a result of the feedback that we were getting from the market. I had my first experience product managing and running an engineering team and trying to triage and roadmap and, you know, leverage resources to build product that would, you know, that would have a real impact. I did 100% of our sales motion, you know, on both the supply side and the buy side, and got lessons in go to market and fundraising. You know, we had raised like a seed, and then, you know, we're trying to fundraise again without a lot of traction. And so on all of those sort of pillars of early stage business, we essentially missed and I got, you know, just like a rapid education in how difficult it is to find product market fit and how to spin something up, you know, in those kind of very nascent and precious first 2 years, and how to de-risk that. So it was extremely informative.
No kidding. Obviously, it sounds like one door closes and another one opens. And in this case, one opened with a bang because you were able to crossroads with another entrepreneur called Josh Abramson, who also has been on the show and who maybe, you know, some people recognize here as the one that was the founder, you know, behind Vimeo. So how did you guys connect it?
We were introduced, you know, I was leaving and we were looking for my next thing. We were introduced through a mutual friend, someone that I met through the New York Tech Meetup. And he told me that he had sold Vimeo and College Humor and Busted Tees to IAC. And he told me that he wanted to buy Busted Tees back, that it was a profitable cash flow business that he thought had a lot of potential, and that he was looking for a partner to help him run it. And he and I really clicked and connected over the idea of having an internet-based business that could be cash flow generative and profitable. That was, you have to remember at that time, this is 2011, you know, even the good tech companies, many of them didn't even have revenue. This was like pre-revenue days of the internet, no less profit. And so it was a really foreign concept to actually be profitable. And we were both really energized by like the potential of that. And sort of what we saw in the business, you know, in the more traditional sort of private equity sense of like, well, this thing hasn't really been run very well. So anyway, he was able to get that, you know, kind of finagle that business out of IAC, and we went about it. And because we were running it as a cash flow business, over the next couple of years was really an exercise in fine tuning the details of the business. And that was also extremely educational, because there was no margin for error, because we were profitable. We had a very small team. It's like 10 people. And I personally was sort of tuning and optimizing every detail of the customer acquisition lifecycle, of the web product, of the supply chain, to squeeze out, you know, profitability and to grow it. And so it went well. We doubled the business. We were making money. But it was clear to us that it wasn't a scalable model, particularly as, you know, by this time it's 2013. And what was in vogue at that time was Living Social and Groupon and Gilt and all of these group buying sites. And what had happened was they had come in and attacked the digital advertising space with unprofitable ads where they would spend 80 cents on the dollar, you know, to acquire a customer. And here we are trying to do it profitably. And we said, there's no way that we can compete in this marketplace and scale. And more deeply, in thinking about what Busted Tees was, which was essentially just a D2C retail brand, it had no underlying network effects. It wasn't a product. It wasn't a digital product. It was just a retail business with digital distribution. And I was confronted, you know, through this kind of painstaking optimization of this thing, the limitations of a traditional business that you're sort of masquerading as an internet business. And in my view, at that time, in terms of consumer and internet business, and I was really thinking about like the Web 2.0 world at that time, was one that was participatory and community-based, one that gave access and power to a large group of people and allowed them to all participate in something. And so, and we had the example of Vimeo to look at and say, hey, look at that. Why is that so successful? That's successful because you've created a platform for other people to be creative. Whereas Busted Tees was essentially our own platform of creativity for ourselves. Like, we were making everything. And so this sort of, you know, out of this was born the idea for Tee Public, which was to be a marketplace for independent designers and artists, where essentially they could build their own version of Busted Tees, and they could design. And we could host it on an aggregated marketplace, and we could handle their supply chain for them. As a byproduct of having owned Busted Tees, we came across new printing technology that allowed you to print one of one, off of a digital print file, so that you could print one T-shirt or one art print, and there was no, you didn't have to take any inventory risk. And so we felt that supply chain model paired with a digital content model could be extremely powerful. But honestly, it sounds better in retrospect because it was just an experiment. You know, we didn't really know, but we did, you know, take a little of our money and put this hypothesis together and got a small community of designers on the platform. And the rest is sort of history. I mean, it grew every month thereafter, probably for 10 years. And we grew it. And again, as part of our thesis, we grew it profitably. We never raised venture or debt in the business. We were profitable every quarter for the entire life of the business. And the business was really designed to be a profitable business in the sense that you had a digital product and you had a supply chain that required zero cash. So we had no cash in inventory. It was a perfect retail business, essentially. And we were able to aggregate, you know, an incredible amount of content. Eventually, probably by the time we sold it, maybe, you know, probably 100 times more SKUs than Walmart has of content on the platform.
What would you say was your biggest lesson around scale?
I think two things come to mind. So the first was, we figured out early in the business what our North Star was, which was that we found that through the data, it's like a known that marketplaces tend to be supply side driven. But we were able to find in the data the correlation between the supply side of our business, which essentially was designers uploading new designs like content, and the relationship between that activity and the demand side, which came through organic traffic, SEO, and paid search, and all of this. And so once we understood, if you increase supply, demand in this particular model is on a real flywheel and it will follow, then we were able to forecast into the future, like, how much supply do we need to aggregate in order to achieve what sort of level of demand at this correlation? And then we became convicted and deployed, you know, for the next 3 years, I would say, nearly 100% of our resources into growing the supply side of the marketplace, nearly ignoring the demand side of the marketplace, because we just were completely convicted that we needed to take care of the artist side and that if we did that, that the customers would follow, and we were rewarded with that, you know, for having that conviction, because that was sort of how the model really worked. And so we were voracious about very, very deliberately aggregating supply, whereas our competitors, I think we're more focused on the demand side and on the customer side, which is natural. And that was also to our benefit, because we were the most supply side driven of the sort of competitive set that we were competing with.
Now, in this case, you know, what was it like going through the acquisition? Because I'm sure that was quite the nerve wracking going through that, you know, as a first time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing that I think was what's great about being a non-venture backed company and a profitable company at that was that Josh and I didn't feel pressure to sell the business. There was no gun to our head. We were having a good time, and the business was in a good position. And so the acquisition was opportunistic. We weren't looking for it. It came looking for us. And we only did it when we became convinced that this would be a really healthy outcome, you know, for us and for the future of the business. And so, you know, as the actual reality of that neared, it does become very sort of nerve-wracking and stressful, because, you know, you sort of feel like your whole life is like, you know, in 6 weeks of diligence and uncertainty. But I think we probably had a better experience maybe than some, as I said, because if it didn't work, we had a good cash flow business, you know, we were okay. And then after, you know, there's a huge adjustment period where we had to, Josh left, and I, you know, stayed with the business ultimately for another 3 years, and we had to, you know, learn how to operate within a public company, ecosystem that was in a foreign market, which was Australia, work with a, you know, public board. I had no board before that. I had no investors. Now I have public company investors and a public board of governance. So it was a complete 180, I would say. And so, you know, but it was a, you know, it started off, I mean, as a really good experience. And what helped, I think, was the business grew a lot in that time period. So it was an extremely, you know, the acquisition was a big success. And it helped a lot. It helped the broader company a lot. And so I think that makes life easier when everybody's winning.
Well, I mean, winning, you know, 40 million plus of a transaction without outside investors is quite the success, Adam. So good stuff.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Now, obviously, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And I'd like to talk now about your latest company, you know, Parable. So how did the idea, you know, come knocking? Because obviously you were spending now time in different boards and, you know, doing different type of work at a strategic level. So how did you start to really come across the problem, and why did you decide to take action?
Yeah. So when I was, you know, post-acquisition with TeePublic, you know, one of the sort of things that I did in that time was look across the two organizations at how they were the same and how they were different, and where do some transformation work around efficiency. And somewhat serendipitously, after I left, as you said, I started doing board work, and all of the board work that I ended up doing was in companies that were going through transformation and large changes in their structure. And in all of that, my reflection essentially was that, when it comes to company transformation, which typically is around, organizational design, resource allocation, how should this operate, and how should this organization invest in itself in order to produce the outcomes, that it desires, that there is a severe data gap. And so when I think about how we built TeePublic, and this goes back to the story that I was telling you about really fine-tuning, every dollar at Busted Tees. Well, we did this at TeePublic, where we thought about, the relationship between content acquisition at TeePublic and how that would impact demand. And I had all of this data, deep data that we built, like what we invested in around the life cycle of an artist and what their value was at TeePublic, and the life cycle of a customer. And I had hundreds of data points on each customer and each artist, right? But by the time we were post-acquisition and, we're like, 600 people, and these boards, companies that I'm working in similarly, there's essentially no data, telemetry data, to really understand what is going on inside of these companies. And so, in the 20th century, people would say, I know that 50% of my advertising budget works, but I don't know which 50. Nobody says that anymore because the digital advertising closed that data gap. But when it comes to people and operations, we know more about our customers than we know about our employees and our own company. And so I think that data gap really struck me as something that is severe and just an incredible inhibitor on a company's ability to create alignment and efficiency in driving towards its strategy. And so when I first started to play with large language models, my co-founders and I really started thinking about where unstructured data, fragmented, unstructured, messy data, which is all of operational data inside of a company, essentially, which happens, operations of a company happens across hundreds of software tools, and it's all unstructured, and most of it happens in language form. We thought about how can AI be used to make sense of all of that complexity, and decode it and distill it into something that is insightful so that organizations can start to reconceive of themselves, in an AI future, in an AI world. And so that is sort of the genesis, at least, for where the idea of Parable came from.
So I guess, hey, for the people that are listening, how do you guys make money at Parable? What is the business model?
Yeah. Parable is an enterprise software business. Essentially, it works with large enterprises as the foundational system for AI transformation. So it creates a baseline of all of the way that an organization is spending its collective time. And so it baselines essentially like, what is your organization today? And then we, as a result of that diagnostic, we identify how the organization can be transformed and made more efficient through AI. And then we implement that. And then we measure, because we established a baseline, what the impact was of AI on the organization or of traditional transformation, so that you can create like a continuous improvement loop that is like a virtuous cycle. And you can sort of reconstitute a company around a new way of working and a more efficient and aligned way of working. That I think is, essentially in greater alignment.
So I guess in this case, then, how did you also think about, VC versus non-VC? How was that the thought process too?
Yeah, well, as I said, obviously, you know, TeePublic, we had a very strong thesis about not using venture. And I think I still would give that same advice to somebody who's going into retail, that I think retail businesses are poor candidates for venture. And I think that's more or less been proven out over all the retail venture deals that were done, 10 years ago. This is an enterprise AI, kind of cutting edge technology business. And so I think it's a perfect business for venture. And so I don't think venture is good or bad. I think it's just a tool that is or is not applicable to certain kinds of business models. This is a business model, what we're doing, that I think is ideal for venture, because we believe that the market size essentially is, $500 billion to $1 trillion that we're going after. We need to invest in and employ, and are doing so, some of the best AI engineers in the country. And we need to build a product and a motion that can deliver for, Fortune 500 companies. And so the space that we're going after, is so big. You need the support of venture to get on your side and give you the capital to really go after an opportunity like this. I think that having real telemetry data around operations is a universal problem that every enterprise and every even smaller business faces. I think to go after a problem of that size and really solve it and really solve it through product, you need the support of venture, and we're lucky to have it.
How much have you guys raised to date? And what was that journey? Because I'm sure that now after your earlier success, it was not that hard to get it.
We raised in mid 2024, so not that long ago. We raised $5.2 million in our pre-seed, and we very intentionally chose to do that pretty much exclusively from founder and operators. So there are some funds, but all of the funds that are in that round are funds that were created by ex-founder operators. And so we have founder of HubSpot, of Ramp, Vimeo, of course, Superhuman, early Squarespace, early Gainsight executives, the sort of Bombas, the list goes on and on, amazing founders. Because we wanted to put together just this like group of champions who knew what it meant to build a company, and we were fortunate to do that in that round.
So, Adam, let's say you go to sleep tonight, and you wake up in a world where the future of Parable is fully realized. What does that future look like?
I think that looks like where we have built a digital twin and a data structure on top of organizations. You can imagine governments as well. You can imagine healthcare systems, who can then speak to their data in natural language, and they can say, "Look, what I need for this organization is to produce, a certain budget and hit a certain amount of OPEX and EBIT." But I also don't want to mortgage the future of the organization. I need to, I need to build towards these strategic pillars that I think set us up for the future. Based on all of the real data and real work, simulate thousands of versions of my organization for me in terms of organizational design, of resource allocation, and of operational process and workflow. And tell me what the most optimal options are given my desired outcomes. And then give me a plan to move from point A to point B. And then eventually, I actually want you as a is a group of agents to help me execute that plan.
I love it. So, Adam, we're talking about the future here. I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's say I'm able to bring you back to the tech meetup days, and those days where the founder was throwing iPads and breaking them on the stage. I mean, I was right there with you, probably under the same roof at that time. But let's say you had that younger self, you know, right there next to you. You guys are sitting down together. Now you're able to go back in time to sit down with that younger Adam, close to that younger Adam, in that whole incredible, exciting universe that was developing of startups in New York. And you're able to just say, whisper, you know, to that younger self, say, here, one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think I would tell him that to think as big as absolutely possible, and to not shy away from that. And that in approaching and tackling like the biggest problem that you can find, that, you know, everybody's going to build their business in a different way. And there is no exact playbook. And so while it is important to study the masters and to know, you know, all of the frameworks, I think that you have to build with some amount of intuition, and you can trust that, and that's okay. Like you're going to have to trust yourself to go after it and to make the right decision. And I think if you're building if you're being integral, that will happen.
I love it. Adam, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can find us at askparable.com and you can email me at adam@askparable.com, and I'm happy to chat.
Amazing. Well, Adam, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.